You and I back together. It's Connecticut Today for Tuesday, July 27th, 2021. A return visit from Daniel Ortner. He's an attorney representing the Pacific Legal Foundation. They registered a legal victory a few days earlier on behalf of someone soliciting charitable donations in the state. A federal judge calling a temporary timeout on a long-running Connecticut law that he believes is not fair to those looking to raise money in the state. The Pacific Legal Foundation arguing successfully on behalf of the plaintiff in that case. So Daniel outlined that for us. I also had a few thoughts during the show after news broke that school mask mandates may be coming back. My thought is everybody needs to relax about mask mandates. In my opinion, wearing a mask, folks, it's not that big of a deal. Want to welcome back this gentleman on the show. We've had him on before as one of the capable attorneys from the Pacific Legal Foundation. Attorney Daniel Ortner joins us. Now, Dan was involved, as the Pacific Legal Foundation was, in a case that I read about the other day, interesting, regarding free speech, the First Amendment, and charities and fundraising issues, and it came out of Connecticut here. And Dan, welcome back to WICC. How are you?
Doing great. Thanks for having me.
So talk about this case involving the state of Connecticut and somebody who was looking to raise money here for a foundation, and the state had they inquired about some information that was a question here. Yep. Let's break this case down.
Yeah, absolutely. So Adam Kissel, he's a well-known in the education activism community. He advocates for things like school choice, for individual rights for parents to control their child's education. He wants to fundraise for an organization, the Jack Miller Center. They do civic education for K-12 and colleges, teaching about the founders' vision for America. And he wants to register. He wants to fundraise for them in different states to use his network. He has a lot of connections in the philanthropy world, so he wants to fundraise for them. Found out that Connecticut had some very onerous rules for registering to fundraise in the state of Connecticut. Some very unusual ones that most states don't have. The most, I think, unusual or burdensome one was a requirement that before a fundraiser is able to raise money for an organization, they have to 20 days before they're going to speak. Tell the state they're planning to speak, and give the state a copy of the script or promotional material or anything that they're going to use to share with a prospective donor. They have to give that material to the state of Connecticut before 20 days before they're allowed to go speak. So that's, I think, problematic in many respects. And the court in Connecticut last week found that likely violates the First Amendment and prevented enjoined the state of Connecticut from enforcing those requirements. It's really unusual. No other state, you know, very, very few other jurisdictions have anything like this, where you have to tell the state what you're going to say in advance. So that burdens your ability to speak spontaneously and freely. You shouldn't have to tell government bureaucrats what you're going to say, give them the script, give them anything you're going to share with someone when you're fundraising. And so that's a major infringement of First Amendment rights. And the court agreed with that. The other piece of the Connecticut law that we challenged is a requirement that all fundraisers maintain the names and addresses of all donors for several years and make that available to the state on demand. So that goes to the kind of donor privacy issue, which is a really hot topic right now. The Supreme Court just had a big decision last month upholding First Amendment rights of donors and charitable groups to keep that information away from the state. And so that's another issue that Connecticut also implicates with their charitable fundraising laws.
Daniel Ortner is the guest. Dan, hang on. I want to get into this a little deeper, and maybe you can tell us after the break here, what did the state say here? Do they even try and defend this? Did we hear from the Attorney General's office? Attorney Daniel Ortner is with us, Pacific Legal Foundation. How about that, huh? I never knew Connecticut had these onerous, sound like it to me, regulations. Traffic and weather together, 3:36 on WICC. Last Friday didn't really make the news in a lot of areas, but a federal judge with a preliminary injunction, that's a legal timeout, to the state here on a couple of onerous, at least the judge thinks so, and the Pacific Legal Foundation thinks so, a couple of onerous regulations here on fundraising here in Connecticut, brought by a gentleman who runs a think tank, a fundraising organization promoting educational issues. Daniel Ortner is the guest. He part of the Pacific Legal Foundation, and you can check them out online, pacificlegal.org. Adam Kissel was the plaintiff here, and as Daniel said, the judge at least calling a timeout on two issues here, the fact that the state requires a text of what any fundraiser is going to say 20 days out, and also requires names of donors to be kept on file and available to the state for a certain amount of time. Daniel, what was the state's argument here? Did they even argue this? Was there anyone from the Attorney General's office here?
Yeah, they defended these policies, and I think, you know, in kind of a funny way. You know, when you're violating free speech, the government needs to have a compelling reason to do so, and they have to do so in the least restrictive, least harmful to free speech way possible. But the state's defense was basically, we're going to interpret everything so narrowly that it's not going to hurt anyone. They basically said, well, look, you don't really have to do anything 20 days in advance. You can once a year file a form with the state. You don't have to do anything too far in advance. And you don't have to give us any real details of what you're going to say. You would just give us a rough outline of your idea of what you're going to say. Now, the problem with what the state said was that's not what the law actually says. The law says you have to give a script and promotional material. So the law says you actually have to give them what you're going to say. And second, if that's the case, if all they want is this very loose outline that doesn't give any real information to anyone, then it's not serving any compelling interest whatsoever. If the point is, you know, to prevent fraud or some other kind of fundraise abuses, then when you make it so narrow that it doesn't give any information to anyone, it's not serving that purpose. So I think the state kind of shot itself in the foot with its arguments. It tried to narrow the law to reduce the harm, the First Amendment harm, but in doing so, it really showed that it doesn't have a compelling interest for this.
How long?
Really gratuitous.
Yeah, Daniel, how long? You said it was an old law, and I don't mean to put you on the spot here, but does this go back decades, numerous years? I mean, when was this plugged in here?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of these laws are from the 1970s. Around then, a lot of states enacted fundraising regimes, registration regimes. Connecticut just went a little further in some respects than many other states. And, you know, one thing, for instance, with the donor identity requirement that you keep names and addresses of your donors, the state conceded that since the law has gone into effect, they are not aware of ever requesting this information. The office of consumer affairs said they did not remember the current person there never remembered seeking the information and is not aware of anyone else seeking it. And so that again showed, like, why are you requiring this? It potentially chills donor speech. You know, donors are aware of what's happened in California with the Americans for Prosperity case of the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
You know, the state there leaked donor information. People got targeted. People were boycotted or lost jobs over their donations to organizations. And so donors are wary. Donors are not going to give money if they think there's even a chance their name would get out there. And so, you know, if they've never needed that information once in decades, why force fundraisers to keep that information in the odd chance that it will someday be useful? But in the meantime, you're chilling speech, chilling donations right now in the process. And so I think the court rightfully said that doesn't meet muster, that isn't justified because it does chill speech in that way.
Yeah, and to me, Daniel, look, I'm no legal scholar here. I'm not an attorney, but even I can say, well, okay, if you never use the law and you say, well, it's only kind of there now, take it off the books. Have the General Assembly here, the State House and the State Senate vote to take this law off the books. Why don't they do that?
Right, and they should do so. And I've heard that they might be trying to do so for at least some of these provisions. I hope they do so. When you're talking about the First Amendment, the law needs to be extra protective of speech, because if your speech is chilled, if you feel afraid to speak because you're going to get punished for it, then you're not going to speak, and ideas are not going to get out there into the marketplace of ideas, and people are going to be silenced. And so that's why the First Amendment, in that area, the First Amendment, the courts have been extra protective of the that chilling effect on speech.
And
being willing to say, look, laws need to be extra, extra clear, extra protective of individuals to make sure that speech is not chilled at all.
And I think, Daniel, you brought up a very good point a couple of seconds ago, a couple of times since we started speaking here. It's not so much the organization. I mean, they're out front. A lot of these organizations on the left and the right, by the way, on both sides, are very proud about what they profess. But you're right. In today's cancel culture, if you are found to have donated to an organization that the mob doesn't agree with, they will come down on you like a ton of bricks.
There are a lot of examples, especially out of California, with Proposition 8, the gay marriage amendment several years ago. Back in 2008, there were people fired, businesses that were boycotted, people that lost their livelihoods because the donations became public. So this is not hypothetical. It's not abstract. Just in the last couple of years, this has happened to donors across the country. And, you know, I mean, you might think this organization that he's fundraising for is not as controversial. It's not, you know, on a social issue quite the same way. But you've had controversies erupt over things you never would have thought would be controversial before.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't, as a donor, you're not going to feel comfortable donating if you worry that it means you're going to get fired because of your job. You're going to be targeted by the Twitter mob. So it really does chill donor activity when you require disclosure and you require people to not be anonymous. And really, anonymity, you know, the right to speak, the right to be anonymous, goes back to the founding era. The writers of the Federalist Papers are the most prominent example of relying on privacy and anonymity to get their voice across. So it's a tradition that has root in the founding of this nation and that the Supreme Court has recognized deserves protection, the right to give anonymously, to not have your identity be disclosed to the world. And so I was really happy to see the Supreme Court defend that in the Americans for Prosperity case. And I believe that we are going to prevail in this case as well to defend the right of donors to continue to give anonymously without fear of retaliation, without fear of their identity being disclosed.
Okay, finally, Daniel, what happens now? The judge didn't kill this completely. This is a preliminary injunction.
Yeah.
What's the next legal course here?
Yeah, so we're doing discovery right now with the state. They're going to be giving us documents and information from the state, and we're going to keep moving forward to see. Eventually, the goal is to get a permanent injunction to say this law is completely unconstitutional and cannot be applied to anyone. And you know, given the judge's preliminary injunction decision, that's very likely. He said, you know, we're extremely likely to prevail on the merits of this case, and so I feel very confident that we are going to prevail and that this law is going to be struck down so that other fundraisers and other individuals can speak freely and not have to worry about being stifled by the state of Connecticut.
Attorney Daniel Ortner with the Pacific Legal Foundation. Dan, good to talk to you again, and we'll chat down the road. Thank you. We appreciate it.
Yes, Paul, thanks for having me.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye. There you go. All right, see that, folks? A law that was on the books here for years that the state claims they never used, but it's still there. And a judge has called a timeout on that law ever being used, at least for now. A lot of you folks probably out there wondering, say, hey, is the governor going to order more mask mandates in the state? Well, apparently he was asked about that earlier today in a story just posted by Hearst Connecticut Media. Nicholas Rondinone's story here, the Connecticut Post. The governor says Connecticut will likely follow the new CDC guidance on masks. Now, Connecticut does not stay, says here in the story, let me break this down for you here. Connecticut does not immediately fall into the areas of the country where the CDC recommends fully vaccinated people wear masks inside a public setting. The new recommendations apply to those in areas with substantial to high community transmission. But the CDC, as of today, is listing Connecticut as having a moderate spread. You got that? So we are considered by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to right now be going through a moderate spread. So it's not as bad as going with a high spread, but it's not as good as having a low spread. See how I did that? I figured that out all by myself. Ahead of the official announcement from the CDC on vaccinated people wearing masks, Governor Ned Lamont said, now here's what the governor said. I'm going to read this to you. You tell me what he means here. The governor said, quote, if this is the way they end up going, we probably continue to follow their lead and say that would be our recommendation as well. The CDC also revised its guidance about masks in schools that had initially recommended that fully vaccinated students and staff members could go without face coverings. But, the governor said today he would tend to track with what the CDC recommends on schools, but he has yet to make a final decision on the matter. So your kids, if I'm interpreting this right, boys and girls, your kids could be masking up this fall. Yeah, well, not even fall. A month from now, late summer. The governor said, give me another couple of weeks to see whether we're Florida or we're Connecticut. If we're Connecticut, I think we give a little more discretion because we've earned it. You know, 2 weeks, stuff might be happening, and we've got to see. So there you go. I get. So I just wanted to bring those highlights to you from the story that went up in Hearst, Connecticut media when this go about 10 minutes ago. So what do you think of it? Do you look, it's not the end of the world. And I know there are people out there that, for whatever philosophical reason, I know there are people out there that don't want kids wearing masks in school. Listen, it's not the end of the world. It's not. It's not. You may not like it. You know what? Kids, this is only my personal opinion here. Yes, I was a kid once. I have one. He's not a kid anymore. He's 27 years old. God bless him. Look, kids are pretty, they're pretty resilient, right? I mean, come on, I see kids wearing masks all the time. I see them wearing masks all the time. And I know there are people who file court briefs and people who say, well, you know, the whole mask thing, it's traumatizing to the kids. They can't breathe. Really? No, honestly. Really? Really? Are there cases of, I'm asking this as an observer of the news, as an observer of the human condition. Are there kids really traumatized by masks? There might be. I'm sure they're scattered around. But have we really seen cases of this mass traumatization of kids who are wearing masks? I mean, honestly. Yeah, there may be a few kids spooked by the whole thing, but I don't know about you. My son was pretty resilient. I'm sure you have kids and grandkids and nieces and nephews who are pretty resilient to this stuff. If you explain to a child what's going on, are they going to go nuts? I don't know. I was in a mall the other night. I saw some really small kids bopping around, having a great old time, and they had face masks on. I'm saying to myself, doesn't seem to be bothering him. He doesn't have a care in the world. He's riding the little merry-go-round. Doesn't bother her. Looks like they got a new toy from whatever toy store was there. So, I don't know. Are we going to see, you know, this sort of mass hysteria again by, you know, some parents, some politicians, or are we going to perhaps maybe allow cooler heads to prevail? We'll have to see what the governor says. But let's remember that kids are sometimes a lot more clear thinking and resilient than their moms or dads or other adults are.